Wireless was still using massive amounts, so naturally, it didn't take. Tim's theory of keeping the band straight on the road was farcical. Basically, therapy 411. He would have his secretary dial information for AA meetings in the towns where we were playing. Dial tone. Start counting. One chimpanzee, two chimpanzee, three chimpanzee, four chimpanzee, five chimpanzee. Cue Lily Tomlin, switchboard operator.
How may I direct your call?
Yes, LA, downtown Los Angeles, AA, please. Thank you, I'll wait.
The number is...
I mean, that would take 1 minute, wouldn't you say? Two, you dial the number for AA in L.A. Hello, what's the address there? Do you have meetings? What days? That was Tim Collins' plan for keeping Aerosmith clean on tour. Tim Collins found an apartment for Teresa and me in Beacon Hill, Boston, and another one for Joey. Then we moved from that apartment to a better one in Brookline. Teresa and I started going to a methadone clinic in Kenmore Square to try and get clean ourselves. This is fall 1986. I got down to 5 milligrams a day at the methadone clinic because I didn't like the way things were going. There was too much blow and too much heroin, and I knew if I didn't do something, it was going to be the end. Who knows if I'd have made it on my own, but I was on my way down. No one told me to go to the methadone clinic. Teresa and I just did it. We were going to get married. We were going to have kids. We needed to change our lives. One day, Tim called me and said, "There's a conference called the Japan tomorrow morning, so you gotta be over early. Be at the office no later than 7 a.m. Drag myself out of bed, get down there, and what do I see but the entire band, on time, suspicious in itself, and all looking very serious, all sitting at a round table, and presiding over the round table is High Lord Doodledum, the therapist Lou Cox. He singles me out and points his finger at me. What did I do now? Or let's rephrase that. What did I do that every fucking body in this band hasn't been doing up until this morning? And I'm not even sure about that. But they're all looking fucking smug because it's Steven that's to be burned at the stake. It's pretty intimidating when your band members, your manager, and this self-important authority on mental health are sitting there in judgment and I'm shaking and jonesing. Your own band, the firing squad, Aerosmith and Wesson. Big shot doctor from New York tells me this is an intervention, which turns out to mean I have to listen to all the fucking complaints about my behavior from everybody in the band, and I can't speak. Steven, just listen to the guys in the band. They want to address some of the issues of your behavior. Is that okay? Fuck no. But what am I going to say? He starts going around the room from Joey to Brad to Tom to Joe's, all that. When you did that, I felt shit. Steven, Joe says somberly, I felt betrayed when I was playing my guitar and you nodded out at the keyboard at rehearsal yesterday. What are you talking about? You gave me the dope. We both did the same shit. We crushed up a DeLauded and shared it. And you fell asleep right after me. Therapist. No talking, Steven. Next up is Tom. When you yelled at me last week, I could tell you were doing too much blow. I got really angry with you.
What?
The fucking blow came out of your sock, you fuck. Steven, you can't speak. Then Joey pipes up. I got really upset when you started throwing stuff around soundcheck the other day and I suspected you were doing blow. Joey, I said, why would you need to speculate about that? We both did a line right before that. That's what I mean. You just become so blatant about it, like when you did blow off my drums yesterday. What are you talking about? You gave me... It was your blow, and you laid it out for me. Steven, please, let them talk. Jesus. I've unknowingly slipped into Ratology 101. The study of why is the rat behaving like that? First you shoot the rat up with adrenaline, then it runs into a wall and breaks its neck. Conclusion. That rat's behavior was clearly deviant. We must do something about this. The big shot psychiatrist is getting theoretical. He's got a thesis. He's the authority. Us lowly drug addicts know nothing. He's doing this whole examination of behaviors, but no one's allowed to know why the rat behaved like that. I go, "Excuse me, professor, do you think it had anything to do with shooting that rat up with adrenaline?" Oh, no, no, no. It couldn't be that. Don't you understand? It's that rat's behaviors we're studying here. Revive that rat and kill him again. That was me. I was the experimental rat, the deviant rodent whose behavior must be modified. Well, it's a big band, and we figured we'd have you go one at a time. We thought if Steven got sober, the rest of the group would also get clean. How reasonable, how rational. Then they said, Steven, if you don't go away, we're throwing you out of the band. What? You're throwing me out of my band? I had to swallow that and suck it up. Anyway, they allowed you to make one phone call, just like the cops, so I called Teresa and she said, don't let them do it. She goes, they can't do that to you. What are you talking about? You did methadone. What do they want from you? I'm coming right over. And just then I thought, you know what? I get it. So off I went. Away to the bins. But wait, you didn't think I was going to slink away from this farce without a peep, did you? Let's go into the special features of the intervention movie and listen to Steven's commentary, shall we? I could have gone, okay, now I get to talk. Well, fuck you, fuck your therapist, I'm leaving. Find another lead singer. And by the way, before I leave, I'd like to ask this high-doodle-dum therapist of yours a few questions. Let me ask you, Dr. Cox, where'd you stay last night? You slept over at Tim's house? You stayed the night before this meeting at the manager's house? When I tell this to professional therapists, they go, what? That therapist stayed with the manager? And Meshman, wrong. Could have lost his license for that. Ha ha, bye. Ding, 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 ding. There's your movie. Oh, it would have gone a little differently. But I didn't. I didn't know how to say that back then. And folks, that's why I'm angry today. What would Spock have done here? How would Spock have dealt with this? Or any respectable drug counselor, like, say, Dr. Steve Chadoff? You know what he would have said? Excuse me, Joe, so you're telling him you're angry at him for falling asleep, but wasn't it your Dilaudid? Well, yeah, but I thought you said that we were to come here and this is about Steven. Well, you see, I can't really point the finger at Steven if you gave him the drugs, so hold on here. Are all you guys still using? And the band, in one noble, rousing cry, would have said, hey, let's all go to a rehab. Maybe we shouldn't all go to the same rehab, but here's what we should do. We should all get clean. Now, that could have happened, and by the way, would have worked. A good, strong mental health worker who saw my point of view would have insisted on that. Well, I came back from rehab, and I said, you know what, you guys? Therapist at the rehab said I'm going to use if I'm around you. So you guys, if you don't get sober, I'm leaving, and I'm going to start another band and use the name. I'd gone away to rehab, but none of the rest of the band did at that time. Brad never went, Joey never went, Tom never went. Joe carried on as usual. Tim Collins was afraid to come down too hard on Joe, and besides, he'd been in bed with Joe from day one because Joe and his girlfriends know how to makey-makey with a manager-manager. Tim Collins, because he'd become tight with Joe while Joe was broken up from Aerosmith, let him stay at his apartment, and Joe proceeded to empty his entire bar. Eventually, Joe did go into rehab at Bournewood Hospital in Brookline, Massachusetts, after his son Tony was born in October of 86. Another notable fucked-up onstage incident happened in Springfield, Illinois, on the Back in the Saddle tour in the late summer of 1986, when partway through the show I just stopped singing and then sat on the edge of the stage and tried to tell jokes to the audience for about an hour until the show got canceled. It was the end of the line. Again. I went into detox at Chit Chat in Wernersville, Pennsylvania, a fabulous rehab, in the fall of 1986. No mood-altering drugs to come down. They give you clonidine. Clona-fucking-dine lowers your blood pressure. You don't want to move. You're so lethargic that you're never going to stroke out, which is a major concern with people coming off drugs. Benzos, Valium, Xanax, etc., are the absolutely worst to come off. I never even told anybody I was on benzos. I thought it was the heroin I was doing before I went in there. I'd got myself down to 5 milligrams at the methadone clinic in Boston, but I was still doing the benzos, massive amounts, snorting them, filling a Coke bottle full. I didn't tell them what I'd been doing, and I was tweaking out, but with the clonidine, I was chilled. They give you a patch of clonidine. I was just... were in a hypnotic state. I couldn't wake up. I couldn't sleep. I had no energy. I would bang into the wall just trying to walk through a doorway. They also gave me Seroquel and Neurontin, which are non-narcotic antipsychotic meds for people that are coming off drugs. I put a blanket on me and cocooned. There still was the Steven Tyler factor in there, but I didn't care if the other patients stared at me. Fuck you. Fuck off. Coming out of that din with an absence of feelings and emotion, your periphery opens up more and more. They said, no food in your room. But of course I've got to break every rule. I brought an apple, a pear, a banana, and a peach, and I put them by the side of my bed. Your smeller goes away when you're doing hard drugs. The deeper, innermost things abandon you. How can you smell when you've got a snout full of drugs? When I noticed my sense of smell coming back, the musty, sweet aroma of the apple and the pear and the peach and the banana, it made me cry. While you're going through detox, you've got to believe in something other than a pill craving and fuck me and fuck you and I've got to have it. You can knock the idea of some higher power, but you've got to believe in something or you're just going to sink back into the muck. You've got to try and see things from a different place. I'm now 30 light years away from that person I was then, yet 12 years later, I still had to get tweaked again. Drug addiction, therapy, relapse. Going through the hell of detox. God, please take this pain away. I'll do fucking anything. God, please, no more. I was in rehab with all the shit that entails, the great epiphanous moments. We're back in the superior vena cava, heading to the heart. We're heading to the ocean. Then one day in the hallway, I saw this poster. It told the story of a man's going through a nightmare journey and his epiphany at the end of it. I so identified with this story. I put myself in the guy's shoes. He's up on a mountaintop in a blizzard, snow and hell. He keeps on walking, pushing on grimly. He thinks he's gonna die and cries out to God to save him. Somehow, he gets down from the mountain and finds himself at the beach. It's warm and sunny. He's walking along, thanking God for saving him. But when he looks down, he sees there's only one set of footsteps. He goes, God, why have you forsaken me? All of a sudden, God appears and tells him, I didn't abandon you. Those are my footprints. I'm carrying you. When I read that, I went to my room and fucking cried. We all need something to carry us. Your mother carries you, falling in love, then rock and roll. Drugs did it for me for almost 20 years. Got me the fucking candy store, didn't it? My wives did it for me. So did my band. Enough about God, for the moment. Let's talk about another religion we don't understand. Aerosmithism. Everybody cleaned up, for a couple of years, maybe three. Then certain people in the band started using again. But it wasn't to the extent of the excesses of the past. It was often so low-key I didn't even know they were doing it. All I know is, I got 12 years out of it. And then in 1987, we made Permanent Vacation. The best album we'd made in 10 years, and the first one we ever did sober. It had Ragdoll, Angel, Magic Touch, and Dude Looks Like a Lady. We knew we were back, opening it up with My Heart's Done Time, my Tro Rico Indian war cry, and wailing inner city sirens on top of two real killer whales. Hayach and Finna singing, recorded at the Vancouver Aquarium. Oh yeah. We were working on Permanent Vacation, and I was talking to Toby Francis, our sound man at the time, about a sampler. You hit the button and whatever goes into it gets sampled for a few seconds, then you can truncate it, manipulate it, and do whatever you want to it. Joe and I were all for it and decided to buy one. The next day, Toby brought one in and tried to show us how to use it. I hit the record button and oh my God, it's recording. I blew a raspberry. Stopped and saved. I played the drums, it grabbed the snare, went into my keyboard. Played a few notes and it grabbed that too. Joe started riffing on his guitar, and I grabbed another bit with a sampler by mistake. I hit play, and it went, Shima Mat, and that was perfectly in time. I said, save that. That's a great fucking noise. God is in the details. I told Toby to save the piece and make sure it didn't get lost. Maybe we could put it on the album somewhere. He did, we did, and the rest is history. For better or worse, it sounds like banana. That little fun thing in the beginning of Dude Looks Like a Lady. I had Bruce Fairburn assign it hard left and right and glue it into the front of the song. It was super stereo ear candy and so beautiful when the band comes in full tilt. I began carving out lyrics, cruise, rused, flues, to fill in the blanks. I had a phrase. It started out as cruising for the ladies. Yeah, right, as if. I could never sing that in a song. I could take any scat, here's looking up your old address, and make it fit. Of course, it works best if there's something to hang my fucking hat on, like a Joe Perry riff, some kind of a hook. I tried a few things, and then a moment went by. I was sitting there with Joe, and I came out with, Dude Looks Like a Lady. Once I tapped into the insanity, the song wrote itself. That was the remembrance of the time the word dude first penetrated my brain. That dudeness came from the first time I heard that word used repetitively, percussively. Yo, dude, yeah, dude, yeah, dude. I was friends with Motley Crue. We were all staying at the Trump International in New York City, and they wanted to go down to a club. I went, yeah, come on, let's go. We piled in the limo, and we had a blast. It was 1991, the year of the dude. The dude thing was just starting to take off in New York City like a virus. It was, dude, hey, dude, 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 man, you are the fucking shit. Dude, man, dude, I gotta tell you, dude, your clothes. I don't have any words for you, dude. Everything was dude, and I thought that is the funniest motherfucking thing. I couldn't, you know, believe it. In my era, it was cool and boss and groovy and let's get down and let's get it on. Dude was really juvenile, but very let's drop in the half pipe and radical. I mean, my mother at the age of 16 wouldn't have used such a jive expression. Anyway, we went to the club, they got hammered, I didn't, and that was that. A couple of months later, the dude thing was ingrained and printed on my brain. I'd be writing songs with people and they'd say, but that doesn't rhyme. But there are all kinds of rhymes. There's soft rhymes like Cher and Fairport Convention. Now that rhymes. I would also try things like, all I want is a room somewhere, in a bra and my underwear. That works because there's a picture being painted. The bra and my underwear jolts. I'd written with the band, and I'd written with Richie Supa, but Richie and I were best friends. Desmond Child was another matter altogether. He was a songwriter brought in by the record label. John Kolodner, the A&R man from Geffen Records, loved the band, so he threw everybody he could at us. Desmond was from Cuba, so dapper and with a mustache. He'd been in Desmond Child and Rouge. And so began a long and involved songwriting career with other people. I loved writing with Desmond Child because we always got into arguments. When I first met him, I'd written all the lyrics to Dude Looks Like a Lady, except the first verse. I got kind of annoyed at myself for not finishing it. I could not find that first verse. I did not have an in. I said, hey, Desmond, I just don't know how to get into this. There were a couple of words here and there he threw in, but he got me into that first verse. He said, pull into a bar by the shore. And I went, oh, God, here we go. I never started a song like that, and I said, well, now I'll give it a try. How about, her picture graced the grime on the door? And he goes, oh, that's great. And she was a long-lost love at first bite, rather than sight. And then he wanted me to sing, I threw my money down on the stage, and well, I didn't care. Are you serious? You want me to say that? I didn't want to say, oh, that's too fey for me to say. So I said, well, it doesn't rhyme. Dude looks like, why would you sing that? Do you know a transvestite? I've actually met quite a few. Dude looks like a lady means nothing, or it means something. I go, all right, in a commercial world, it's good. And not only is it good, but it gets under the hood of what everyone hides. The gay thing. When Desmond started throwing things at me that I didn't know how to use, I should have said, nah, I can't sing that. But it took me a couple years before I could voice my objections that strongly. Just like when I got sober. I could not go into a bar and order a soda. The bartender would ask, you want a beer? Can I get you a drink? I couldn't say, I'll take a ginger ale. Could not say it. Because there was so much shame behind it. Why would I be ordering a ginger ale? Give me a Jack on the Coke. Now that was my natural mode of bar talk. I drank a bottle of Jack with my eggs. It was the norm. At my first AA meeting, I looked around and felt right at home. I got in touch with whatever me had been there back then. I got to meet this fantastic woman who conducted guided imageries. The sessions took about an hour, and in that place, you would learn to slither like a snake, or if you couldn't swim, project yourself swimming across a lake, or saying goodnight to a child that died years ago. You sit there quietly, and the therapists talk to you. Okay, imagine the sun is going down. You smell the warm summer air. Where are you right now? You're at your back door. You're in a chair by your back door. There's a whole room full of people tuned in. Guided imagery. Here comes your dog. Bend down and pet your dog. And in your mind, you're petting your dog. Some of the guided images were so beautiful, so heartrending, people would begin crying. Picture your mom. Can you hear her calling you for dinner? After 10 minutes of doing that with your eyes closed, you are in a very vulnerable state. How sweet is that? Envision a cat that you loved so much, or get on a boat that once sank. Now you're on the boat again. Go out to your favorite fishing spot. You're rowing. People would actually sway back and forth while envisioning the images. In their mind, they were rowing. The therapist might talk to you about your first sexual experience, and you get an erection, but the erection would be in your mind. How would you describe purple? Grape juice, maybe. What does black taste like? Licorice, I guess. I'm trying to think of a color that you can't associate with something that tastes good. Orange, oranges. Yellow, banana. How would you describe what pink tastes like? Pink. Pussy. And that's what I do with songs. I navigate through images. Sometimes I feel like I'm so fucking boring in sobriety, but you've got to remember, when you take drugs, you're just spinning in your own head. So up in your own Kool-Aid, you know? Up in the Kool-Aid, man, but you do not know the flavor. Chapter 11. Getting lost on your way to the middle. A day in the life on the road. Oh, yeah. The permanent vacation tour is going to last 7 months, easy. More likely a year. You wake up, you leave Boston, you're going on fucking tour, baby. This is the first true, more or less, clean and sober tour. 1989 to 1990. And Joe and I have gone from the toxic twins to the detox twins. Still, it's hardly the Goody Two-Shoes tour, so you gotta watch your step when temptation beckons, and trust me, it beckons. Why the need for caution? Because there's wives and girlfriends on this tour. You fuck someone, and even if your wife isn't on this leg of the trip, you know only too well one of those bitches will be the first to get on her cell phone to your wife or significant other and tell all. That's Steven. He's incorrigible. Will he never grow up? My dear, I shouldn't be telling you this, but what was he doing backstage to that slutty piece of jailbait? The silly boy tried to explain the bizarre pose he'd got himself into. She's interviewing me for her high school newspaper. Yeah, right. If you're on tour for a year, you're not fantasizing about drugs and booze and hot chicks so much as you're dreaming about falling into a comfortable bed at the end of that endless day. If you stay at the best hotels, then just scrape $1 million off the tour, because that's what you end up paying for 8 guys in the fucking 4 seasons, deal or no. The tour manager is wheeling and dealing so he can stay in there for free because he brought Aerosmith. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. We stopped staying at the Days Inn in 1977 because we'd wake up in the morning with our backs twisted, thinking about feather beds. It was the era of enough. Plus, there was fucking fans next door banging on the wall. Bam, 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 bam. You're the fucking balls! You're the fucking balls! At the 4 Seasons, you had security. Who gives a shit if it's $1 million off the top? The best tours are the ones that are propelled by hit singles, like the Pump Tour. Pump had Love in an Elevator and Janie's Got a Gun. Permanent Vacation had Angel and Ragdoll. So when we went out on tour, I knew we were 4 deep in hits. I knew it. Oh, I so knew it. The tour is the surfboard. The wave is your popularity, how you're getting played. And if you are, you're going to go through the tunnel. It's a wave from the backside of Hawaii, 20 feet tall, and you're riding that fucker as long as you can ride it. You leave Boston with a wistful heart. Bye. We're going. Sniff. We'll be back in Boston in 4 months, and that's when the family comes to see the show and they start getting their guest list together. The doctors, lawyers, and the candlestick makers, the fucking guy that gave me my canoe, the school teachers, the pharmacist, the caterer, the manicurist, the yoga teacher. You get on the plane, the first gig's in Dallas. You get to your room, you lay out your clothes. You're gonna stay in Dallas and do that hub thing, so imagine we're in the middle of a wooden wheel with these big spokes leading to the different cities we're going to play. We were there for a week, 4 seasons. You wake up the next morning around 9, eat a little something by 10. At 11 you go to the gym, take a shower, you're back in the room by 12, get your room in order and have a little lunch. By 1:30, there's a lobby call. Your assistant says, "You know what? I was just downstairs. There are a bunch of people outside. So I talked to the manager. He says we can go to the second floor. We can walk down a set of stairs and go out the back way. Or you can go out front. Either way, there'll be a car waiting. Whatever you choose. There's about 12 people out front right now. I know if I want to sign autographs, say hello, and run real quick, it'll take me about 6 minutes. That's what I want. Signing autographs for 12 people, you're talking 6 minutes. 20 people, 10 minutes. But security has to know what I know. What if someone has a gun there? John Lennon got blown away by a psychotic fan. What if? And I walk into those situations all the time. I've got 5 bulletproof vests at home. 2 o'clock, you're down in the lobby. You ride back to the airport. 2:30, you get on the plane, a plane you rented. That's going to cost you another $2 million by the end of the run. Scrape that off the top. You get in that beautiful plane of yours. You claim your seat. Mine's on the right, up in front. I put my pens and papers there and scrawl my initials on the table with a Sharpie. To the left of me is a 5-foot bench along the side of the plane. There's one seat across from me where my significant other will sit. Joe is to my left, and then Joey, Brad, and Tom are back there behind me. It's a 10-seater. 5 of us, plus tour manager, security, the stewardess, girlfriends, etc. Stuff it all in, luggage stowed, we leave at 3, and head off to the first venue. The tour manager books it, so we fly for an hour. Sometimes it's an hour and a half, sometimes 2, but not often. Generally an hour and 15 minutes. It's the tour manager's job to set up a tour around a hub. You're flying at 400 miles an hour. An hour and a half gets you to, say, Omaha. You get out of the plane at 4:30. At the FBO, flight base operations, you ask if there's a bathroom. You hope that your tour manager has enough brains to have called ahead and checked this out. We don't get in the cars and go right away. We take 5 to 10 minutes, say hello to the cops, talk about guns. The tour manager can talk to the guy at the venue. Do you have a shower there? No. Okay, now you have to figure out some other way to take a shower before the show. As you're leaving the airport, you see a motel. The tour manager says, "Hold on." And you pull the motorcade over, you stop at the motel and say, "Look, can we get a day room?" By 5 o'clock, you're in your dressing room at the venue. The place holds 20,000 people. You're ready for tonight. You shoot the shit and bullshit for a while. It's 6 o'clock, time for your meet and greet, shaking hands with people from the radio station, fans who have won tickets by being the 5th caller, or the dude looks like a lady, or whatever they do to get their ticket. They're all there in the room with you, asking you questions they already know the answers to. Backstage, nepotism runs wild. DJs and their kin. It's the announcer. It's the morning jock. It's the nighttime jock. It's the 5 jocks gacked on coffee in the morning. The morning show guys. The night show. The 5 o'clock side show. They're all there with their wives and their best friends. So it's a room full of 50 to 60 people. You meet and greet till 7. Around 7, you ask the girls that do the backstage, "What time are we going on?" 9:15. I have to eat 2 hours before I go on stage, so at 7 o'clock, I get the cook to come in. He makes me salmon. I have salmon every night. It's gotta be wild and steamed broccoli. I eat that at 7. I'm done by 7:30 or so. People are still walking in and out, guys from the opening band, shooting the shit with Kid Rock. "Where's your girlfriend?" Pamela Anderson comes walking in. "How goes it?" I said. I remember the first time I saw her at the MTV Europe Music Awards at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. She was going out with that guy in Poison, Bret Michaels. She was hot, so I lied and said, "What the fuck are you doing with that jerk? You knew I was going to be here." So pretentious, so rock star. But then again, I drink a gallon of her piss just to see where it comes from. It's now like 7:30. My assistant goes, "ST," and she points to her watch. "Come on." 9:15, we go on. So 8 o'clock's the lockdown in the dressing room. Lock it out. No one comes in. I set my timer for an hour. When it stops, it goes... It's my fucking time, because I can't keep time to save my life. Pamela comes in again. We're shooting the shit. Some people are still pulling on me, going, Steven! I sit down and do makeup. Makeup takes 20 minutes. Hair, I do myself. After that, I do a little exercising, get on my stretch mate, get on the floor and do a little yoga, stretch those muscles out. If I don't, I know I'm going to feel it later on. Work out with my 20-pound weights on my board. Now it's getting around 8:15, and I've got to warm up, singing. So it's all the way to the top, so you can't go any further, then all the way down to the bottom. Just watch that episode of 2 1/2 Men, you'll know what I do. I'm the one the guy next door is complaining about when I practice my scales. Then I get the countdown. They call out to me to give me the time I have left till I have to go on. 15 minutes! That's when I first get that, oh shit, I gotta go on stage, jolt. Any bug that I got flies out of my body because it knows deep down inside it's gonna be 2 hours of insanity. I'm throwing a party for 20,000 people. I love it. I'm addicted to adrenaline. 5 minutes! Someone calls out. We walk down the side of the stage and the tape rolls. It's a 5-minute film. I got my big burly friend KC Tebow and his wife to take pictures of us that we could project on the screens in the back during the show. KC made an Aerosmith film with a voiceover in the style of the old newsreels. And defending the nation is... We found the reporter that used to do them, got his voice, and put it on the tape. It shows us at various places on tour. And we stopped in Berlin. We could be in Berlin on the European tour. We could be in Prague. We're going to France. It's projected behind us on an LED screen. The LED screen is 40 by 60 feet. When you hear LED, you think a flat screen, but this thing is 5 inches thick. It's set up every night, high-def Aerosmith. We used to have a camera showing us coming out of our dressing room and walking up to the stage. Boring. Been there, done that, not cool. This new montage of scenes Casey came up with out of his head. He's brilliant. Great cinematographer. He did the whole European tour with us, but because he stayed with me and filmed me, some people in the band got a little jealous and knew that I was doing a movie. If I die, KC has explicit orders to make all these clips into a movie and put the thing out so the world can see what goes on with me. My ex-wife Teresa is there. My girlfriend Erin is there in the dressing room. Dan Neer is interviewing me on a boom for XM Radio. I'm getting my face done by the makeup girl. The pitcher from the Red Sox is there with his wife. There I am, ogling girls, philosophizing, chewing people out, hanging out with the Make-A-Wish Foundation kids. I go around the corner real quick because I have to pee. Dan says, do you mind if I come? I haven't warmed up yet, and my cell phone rings. It's Al Gore. So there's all this stuff going on while I'm taking a leak. I tell the makeup girl, you can look if you want. When you're not married, there's all sorts of things you can do. Stuff I could never do when my wife was around. I can't tell you what joy that is. Because with wives, you can't joke. That's part of the bargain. It's all on film, a day in the life. Curtain drops. Aerosmith's on. 2-hour show. The show takes us from 9:15 to 11:15. We're supposed to be off at 11:15. That's a state curfew. If we go over it, we got to pay them a couple of $1,000 a minute. Sometimes it's $5,000 a minute if you're in New York at Madison Square Garden. It's $10,000 every 5 minutes in L.A., and we always go over it. Makes you wonder what Axl Rose paid on his tour. Okay, so we get off stage at 11:15, an hour backstage taking showers, meeting people, talking to girls. 12:30, we're at the plane, we fly back, an hour and a half flight. Like they say, the woman has to be in the mood, the guy just has to be in the room, and that... Being in the mood goes for the lead singer, too. You have to get it up. You have to get up there on stage and flaunt your pedals. You're asking yourself, what is he saying? Where is he going with this? Is he on drugs again? Better call Tim Collins. On stage, who takes the brunt in Aerosmith? Me. When your audience doesn't respond to a song, who feels worse about it? Who owns it the most? The guitar player or the lead singer? No wonder I got lead singer disorder. And what is the leading cause of LSD? Guitar players. They drive lead singers crazy. Guitar players can put their amps on 10 and have a roadie change their strings. Thank you. On stage, no one's going to hear if Joe's guitar is out of tune. It's been out for years. It was out for most of the 70s. Now, we have really good guitar techs. Still, it slips. Stuff happens. Joe plays so hard, his guitar still goes out of tune. I always wondered, is it just me? How come only I notice it? It bothers the hell out of me on stage, but the audience doesn't hear a thing. They're stuck on the image of Joe being there, the cool cat they saw on the back of the album. Oh my God, it's him, and it's live, and there he is, Steven Tyler, live and in person. Well, I got news for you. If I for a second sang flat, oh, whoops, in the press, in the paper, his voice was all right, but he kind of missed a couple notes, and they would put their finger on what note it was. Steven Tyler looks good, but his voice is slipping. Maybe old age and years of drugs. Maybe drug rehab. Oh, they'll look for anything. They speculate like crazy. That's why, in my Italian mind, that lawn's got to be mowed and good. It's got to be raked, or I ain't going to the beach. So if I don't sing really good and be all I can be in the Aero Army, ha-ha, they'll be on my case like white on rice. You're in a band, you make it, you're let in the door. Then you have to be realer than the realest reel for people to relate to when fans are standing on their feet for 3 hours to come see you. They need to see a show that evokes something extreme in them. So you've got to telepathically and through body language and song, reach them profoundly, visually, electrically, do something that changes their everything. The song you sang once touched something in their life, something that they can totally relate to. They heard you first on the radio without seeing you. Now they're one-on-one with you by being there. We're on stage, and during the last song, I hear in my ears, Steven, we're doing a run or the cops are waiting. Go right to the car, stage left, stage left. We run out that way. That's when you put on the bulletproof vest, when you hear that goofy cartoony voice saying, exit stage left. I snap into the vest, I'm so hot and just like, I need to sit in the car in just my underwear and a towel with Aaron. She gives me a little something to drink. We get in a police motorcade. The police sirens go off. It's so loud. The noise. Trying to talk over the noise of the police siren, the plane's engines on the runway. Around 12:30, we're back on the plane. The pilot's complaining because he's got to fly so much, and we just came off stage. I guess it's all relative because we all think our problem is the worst until we see someone else's. I'm bitching because I've been on stage for 2 hours and I hurt. Meanwhile, somebody else was building the fucking pyramids. The next morning, you don't have a show that night, but you're fucking dragging your ass. How do you fix a sore back? Back in the gym. You gotta stretch that shit out. I learned that early on, but no jogging. Those guys that run every morning have fucked up knees and legs and feet, just like I do from working out on stage for 30 years. We wear out, and that's a secret that nobody knows. The best exercise for anybody is keeping your hand away from your mouth. Food is kind of a drug addiction itself. I did drugs because it made me feel good. Beginning, middle, end of story. People eat because they got a lot of time on their hands and want to satiate the body. It's fucking great. I love to eat. Being off the road now, I love to eat, but I can't just indulge. 2 o'clock, we're back in Dallas. 2:30, we're dragging our fucking sorry asses into the lobby. What time do we leave? Come on, try and keep up. It's a 12-and-a-half-hour day. I first noticed that about 7 years ago. I always just took it for granted. Ah, it's 3 o'clock. We've got to get to bed. We never do 2 days in a row. In the past, my throat was ripped, and after years of that, I finally went, you guys, fuck you. I'm doing day on, day off, and I don't care how much money you think we're losing. That's what I need for my voice. Joe's guitar tech takes his sorry-ass worn-out guitar and strings, changes them, sets the guitar up for the next date. I don't have anyone to change my strings. 3 o'clock, I fall into my comfortable bed at the Four Seasons and go to sleep. 9 o'clock, my alarm goes off, I get up, order breakfast, go to the gym. And that's my life. Chapter 12. Where you end and I begin again. The goddess. I should be alone. Without girlfriend or significant other. And when I need my love, go to a fair. Go to a mall. I used to say to my wife, Jesus Christ, I get more love from a fucking stranger on the corner than I get from you. Are you tired of me? Oh, I'm just tired of you always being angry. Tired of me being angry. I'm angry for a reason. You always have reasons. True, but I'm supposed to turn into a Stepford husband? Good morning. You look so beautiful. I'm glad you have such nice hair. And your teeth. That face. You look so good. Lovely to see you again. Bye. Ding. Next morning. Hi. Wow, you haven't changed a bit. You look so young. Ding. It's easy to get accolades from kids on the street, but from your exes? Forget it, even when they weren't exes. Instead it was, why do you look at the women like that? That's what I do for a living. I've never had a relationship with a woman who really trusted me. I'm this guy on stage with an outrageous, larger-than-life persona, a persona designed to be over the top, out there, and nasty. Any woman who ever acknowledged that would have put the fire out immediately. If they said what they knew to be true, I knew you were going to fuck all those women. Never did they ever acknowledge that side, ever. But if I fucked anything, it was the fucking Inquisition, even when I just kissed another girl. You're disgusting. Why did you kiss that girl? I kissed her on the cheek. Oh, why would you do that? 'Cause out there, I was in the moment. Do I have to explain every single thing I do in my performance? Should I explain yet another thing I do out there so that you can try and take a piss out of my performance at night? I didn't fuck her, for Christ's sakes. But even at 50, after going through 2 marriages, I didn't have enough brains to go, wow, well, this is so over, and end things with Teresa. I had beautiful Chelsea and Taj, and I wanted the dream to go on. I've been in a band most of my life, and if you live like that, you don't have normal things happen to you, like weekends. Rock stars don't get weekends, time when you can stop being the guy on the lip of the stage. When I had kids at home, I'd think, I gotta get up early like other fathers, mow the lawn, take out the trash. When I'd fuck up, I'd feel bad and call Joe Perry, who doesn't get up until 1 o'clock. I'm a rock star, he'd say. Have you forgotten who you are? Compared to most men who come home every night to their wives and their kids and all that delicious everydayness of normal life, I'm at a disadvantage. Oh yeah, the whole rock star business, combined with a basic male impulse of wanting to fuck anything that moves, does put a kink in the ideal of domestic bliss and the till death do us part thing. I would goggle down at the girls in the front row in the tight tank tops, their nipples sticking out like rocket boosters, because that's my job. My job on stage is to be sexy. That's what I am. It's the equivalent of me saying to my wife, why are you such a whore in bed? To which she'd say, well, it's only in the bedroom. Well, with me, it's only on stage. Well, no, it isn't. You're looking at them like that out here in the parking lot, too. I am? So now I'm bad for being naughty on stage, bad for flirting with girls at home, bad for arguing with her about it. Everything to do with women is a negotiation because it's based on sex. Your boss can tell you, show up, suit up, shut up. But you can't exactly say that to the woman you want to fuck tonight. In this world, you know, its size doesn't matter, and sex isn't everything. But then, why is cheating in a marriage the final straw? By the way, fuck is no longer one word. It's fuck, or fuck, you're gorgeous. It is so expressive. It's fuck. It's funny. Getting married, it's all I, Betty, take Joe, better or worse, death or sickness. Excuse me, did you say better or worse? And then you divorce him? Didn't you take a vow? Weren't we supposed to learn compassion and forgiveness from the Pope? Didn't the Pope once go visit the guy in the hospital who shot him? So how come I can't get none? Why would a man and a woman who call themselves soulmates ever leave each other over something as frivolous as sex? The wife, in a high-pitched voice, says, Well, because it's deeper than that, Stephen. It's really a trust issue.
And that means if I fuck around, you can take all the money out of my account and sell all the animals? Excuse me. But what does a hand job have to do with my bank account? Suddenly they've forgotten everything except that laundry list of what they don't like about you? As soon as I left my Teresa, I became sexually active. Sad to say, but everyone said, wow, you seem so happy now. And I thought, hell yeah. I can go to character breakfasts at Disney World now, whereas in the past, someone didn't want to go. Or whatever it is you like to do and she doesn't. Or vice versa. Your girlfriend, your wife, they're supposed to be your soulmate, but you really never know. When you're in therapy, you find out that you often do things in life out of necessity. Naturally, I didn't want to hear that. There comes a time in a man's life when he realizes he's not getting any younger. I think I'll marry this girl. And if you tell her she's your soulmate, she'll love you even more. Hey, we like to raise goats together, live in the country, eat brown rice, pet the old donkey. And isn't it funny how we found out that we both like... And then one day, she catches you fucking somebody else and it's, I never did like that fucking donkey. You and your fucking donkey. You and your fucking chickens. I never fucking liked them. And I'm bummed out that you never sensed that I didn't like them. And you go, oh my God, but I thought that we were soulmates. Fuck you and your soulmate shit. And in a second, they're gone. In a fucking heartbeat. Any guy that's caught fucking, suddenly everything that the wife loved him for, gone. Behind every rock star, there's the rock star's wife, drop-dead gorgeous, walking around in a thong, the kind of gorgeous woman you jerked off to in Playboy. But after 2 hours in a room with her, you'd lose your mind. She's belittling the rock star, humiliating him. You wonder how that rock star could be with her, because men are imprinted. They just want to get laid. It's a slamming thing. Why does a guy who's the president of the bank want to suck on a high-heeled spike while she's smacking him on his ass with a riding crop that's leaving welts? I'm half man, half woman. Most men are 80% man, like an ape. There's not a lot of female emotion evoked in most males. My generation grew up in a John Wayne world. The macho cowboy or the GI going, I don't want anyone to touch my bitch. I don't want anyone to touch my female. What a crazy fucking thing is that? It's all male ego run riot. Gazoom! I like to jerk off. I like to come. Who gives a fuck what gets you off? Gays love me. I walk into a room full of queens and go, oh, you found me. Still, I gotta tell them, don't even think about hitting on me. I'm a breeder, and you know it. Gay sex just doesn't do it for me. I tried it one time when I was younger, but I just didn't dig it. The idea of some guy pulling my hair back, biting my ear, and shoving his cock in my ass doesn't appeal to me. Sex is the strongest force in the universe. Forget about the grand unifying theory, Stephen Hawking. I'll tell you what it is. Women. Aren't women the strongest sex? What force is more magnetic than that? It's not just pussy. We're attracted to women for their energy. We're attracted to their fluidness, their ability to nurture a baby with not even knowing how. To be able to put up with screaming and crying and colic and shitty diapers where men would go, I am fucking out of here. I'm going to go kill me a saber-toothed woolly mammoth and bring it on home to eat tonight. Waha! We don't have tits. We couldn't nourish a gnat. Hoo-hoo! Based on testosterone alone, guys are fucked. Most women are, can be, a little nuts upstairs, but they're basically nurturers, and we are, used to be, we're created to hunt. We're created to be Ted Nugent. For a million years, we did the hunting. We didn't sharpen our spears and sign a contract. Kill the fucking animal. Blood, guts, blurt. That's why women crawled to the back of the cave and had their babies, so the male wouldn't eat the baby. Animals do it. We're not far from that. There's something going on. In all of our fightings, we have not been able to find that cranial capacity to go from the monkey brain to ours. It kills me. It just kills me. Very rarely will you find a compassionate man who'll say, I'm sorry, or cry. Hell, you join the women doing that. What are you, a faggot? You gay? Be a man. I mean, wow. I'd rather be gay, if that's what gay is. Smell the flowers, like to suck on my thumb, cry, smile big. We keep the vagina hidden. It's too strong in our society. Jesus and Mary Magdalene, it says, and he kissed her. And the rest is scratched out. He kissed her what? Her lips? Her hands? We all know what the Holy Grail was. It was a vagina. Now that really is mystical. Those guys, the Knights Templar, are looking into the chalice, like that scene in Basic Instinct where Michael Douglas can't look at Sharon Stone's pussy, and they go into a swoon. What do you mean the chalice was gold with rubies? Please. Whatever the God force is, it certainly isn't in a golden box. Gold we made. Heaven and hell we invented. Put that in the gold box. Fucking A. Women are different. They can have babies. They can nurture. Nurturing is part of a woman's DNA. But what about remembering anniversaries? Is that part of their genetic makeup too? Even tough chicks like my girlfriend, Erin Brady, get sentimental and pissed off when you don't remember. Last time I was in England with Erin, I got in trouble for that. We were doing the English equivalent of the Grammys. Oasis was playing that night. Well, unfortunately, this big night was also Erin's birthday or our anniversary or something. See, I'm already in trouble because even now I don't remember which one it was. Whatever it was, I realized it along the way or someone told me. A little red flag went up in my mind. Oh, my God. So I called the hotel and said, give her some flowers. But she got it in her head that I took the flowers off a counter or that they otherwise hadn't actually come from me. Which, in a way, Erin, you gotta understand, I'm getting ready to do the Grammys. My head is in the clouds. I don't know what I'm doing, let alone to say happy birthday. Or was it our anniversary? Hey, I probably even messed up on the apology. Listen, I miss my own kids' birthdays, I told her. Never mind what day it is. Well, not with me, I think she said. Finally, I go, oh, okay. We only broke up for 10 minutes that day. When I started to make money, I said to Teresa, you know what, honey? Go buy whatever you want. And she said, really? I can't? Can we get, like, a house? Oh, they forget all that. And then when I come home and say, look, honey, I was a little nasty on tour. It's, what do you mean? What do you mean, what do you mean? Why did I tell her? Because I'm a fucking idiot. Oh, I know what happened. I was in rehab. I was sober. I was trying to be honest about everything. In rehab, they were telling me, well, you should tell her, but it's not me that's saying you should. I took their advice, unfortunately. It's that word, but. When they said to me, but it's not me that's telling you to do it, I should have known better. But is a scary word. It'll get you every time. You know what my uncle said about the word but? It stands for the basic underlying truth is to follow. So when you go, I didn't tell him, but, it means you did tell him. And when you go, I told him, but, it means you didn't tell him. Isn't it a crazy coincidence, or is it fate, that my ex-wife Teresa was a twin and my girlfriend is also a twin? Maybe those 7-year-olds from the choir had something to do with it. When I was younger, if I ever ran into twins, I'd say, how about me and your sister getting together? By the way, if I were on Oprah right now, I'd say, is there anyone out there who's got twin sisters? Email my website tomorrow, let me know. Oh yeah, I don't do email. Of course, me being me, I did ask Teresa about having a threesome with her sister Lisa for years and got so smacked down. I may have asked Teresa's sister Lisa one too many times, but honestly, don't you think twins get that a lot? It's the thing to do, no? I once wrote a song about Teresa and her sister. It's called Push Comes to Shove. I sing it like Tom Waits. Women love me because I sing good, because I'm a rock star, because I'm Steven Tyler. You may say, well, hell, what's wrong with that? What's the big deal about being loved for yourself anyway? And at the end of the day, does it matter that I got laid tonight because the girl's known about me for 10 years and loves Aerosmith? Dream On is her favorite song, so she fucked me. Unfortunately, she's home telling all her friends, guess who I fucked? And sometimes that sucks. Of course, I'm not going to get any sympathy in that department. I just have no life. I didn't even have time to see Chelsea and Taj, let alone go visit. I couldn't because there was so little time and because I do this. Every show, my throat gets strained. My skin, my feet, my back is pulled and twisted. I'm the whirring front man of Aerosmith, their golden goose. At the end of the night, I ache, I can't talk. The rest of the band, they can wake up and they're fine. They don't use themselves as an instrument. They can claim aches and pains so they can be in the aches and pains club too once I start squeaking. Hell, everyone likes to bitch about how wasted and sore and shattered they are, but they can go home on the day off. My wife would see Joe home, call me up, "Why didn't you come home?" And once that starts, it's the beginning of the end because I do day on, day off to rest my voice. And when I start to explain to her in my creaky voice, does she melt and say she understands? I'd be in the Midwest and call home and say, "Guess who's here tonight? Jimmy Page." "Yeah? And I'm here alone. Hope you're having fun." I'd kick the phone and go, "Fuck." They say that the female brain is different from the male brain, and I can fucking believe it. Sometimes I'm ashamed to be a male around women. Men are FM, fucking and money. And women are, you know, psychosexually multi-tracked. We're still in mono. That's why they're all confusing to us. I mean, we're just sort of like, "Hey, I like that. I want that." But they can be both sides of the same question within 2 seconds. It's like David Honeyboy Edwards, the old Mississippi blues singer, used to say that you can't ever win an argument with a woman. Dogs don't remember. They act by rote. They don't even know why they're doing it. When we're in a room full of pussy, do guys instinctively go, "Ugh," like the Neanderthals we were? Do we? I mean, I don't know. I want to talk about women. I want to sing to them. I'll do my lounge lizard act, anything to get through. To her, the one, the girl that I've missed. Decipher this, baby. Riding into town alone by the light of the moon. I'm looking for old Sookie Jones, she Crazy Horse Saloon. Barkeep give me a drink, that's why she caught my eye. She turned to give me a wink, that make a grown man cry. I feel the vertigo of being alone. I'll be working a room, talking to people, joking, telling them stories. They're looking at me, and what they see is this Steven Tyler entity. I began to think of myself in the third person, which is a kind of existential hell. And everybody I know said the same thing except the one person that I wanted to say it to me. And she left me. So it's really lonely, being who the fuck I am. Chapter 13. Trouble in Paradise. Losing your grip on the life fantastic. By the fall of 91, I had 6 years sobriety, but for whatever reason, I wasn't getting along with my band. I'm Italian. I really look at what's going on, so I thought I better go check in someplace and get this sorted out. Around that time, Marco Hudson was working on a Ringo album and put me on the phone with him. Never mind the fact that it was the first time I'd ever spoken with Ringo, one of my heroes, an actual Beatle, and to say the least, I was beside myself. Mark had told me the day before that Ringo had just come out of rehab and was sober, so I got on the phone. "Richard," I said, "I've been butting heads with my band for just about every fucking album we've done."
"I can relate to that," he said.
I thought to myself, if I'm having problems with my bandmates and you're in the Beatles, I can only imagine what you went through. The funny part is that we spoke for almost an hour about all this stuff, and he ends by saying,
"Well, good luck, man. Enjoy your sobriety."
"What do you mean, sobriety?" I said to him. "I've been sober for 6 years. I thought you knew. Didn't Marco tell you?"
"Well, what the fuck are you going there for?"
he said, meaning rehab. "I want to make peace with my bandmates," I said, "so we can write like we did in the old days. I'm following the old adage that you can attract more flies with honey than vinegar. The only problem is, who is the honey and who is the vinegar?" So off I trekked to Arizona IA and checked into Sierra fucking Tucson for codependency to try and find out what the problem was. Now then, how to juggle band and family at the same time? I wanted to see why my relationship with the band was so fucked, so up and down, and not in a good way. In part, it was because of something I hadn't yet grasped, and wouldn't for many years to come. That Tim Collins and Joe Perry had been in bed together, micromanaging the band since day one. I would tell Joe something, and he would tell Tim, and in many instances, by the time he got back to me, it was the exact opposite. It was a triangulated version of the telephone game. Say Tim had it in his head for some reason to want to do something. But instead of working it out between us, he would call Joe and tell him I was out of control, and then call me and tell me Joe was out of control.